This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
All right, Gary.
Hello, Guy. Is there anyone on this planet? Sorry, one more second. Start again.
No, there's no one on this planet. It's just you and me. So I don't actually know why we bother still doing the podcast, really, as there's no one left to listen to it. Because as Jonathan King said, everyone's gone to the moon.
Yes. But I was going to say, is there anyone on this planet that doesn't like Bruce Springsteen?
Probably. And they'll probably leave a comment.
Everyone I know loves Bruce, yeah. No matter what you're into. You love Bruce, right? You love the boss. And would you trust someone who was a musician, a songwriter, and an actor?
I came across one once. Can't say I like the cut of his jib very much. No, absolutely. And an incredibly effective activist.
Ah, yes, of course. Of course, yeah. I've probably made one of the most successful. What do we call those kind of that kind of music? We call it protest songs.
It's a protest. Yeah, it was, because it wasn't for charity. It was a protest song, and also just a great record.
A great record, incredible. Should we talk to this guy?
Let's get him on. Let's get Syl on. It's the one, the only, Mr. Steve Van Zandt.
Welcome to the Raconteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Raconteurs Podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Hello, 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 hello.
Oh, whoa! Oh, hello!
Steve Van Zandt!
There he is, Steve! Remember, what do we call you, Steve?
Steven.
Stevie.
Man, it's such a thrill to have you here, because you... Gary and I like to think we tick a few boxes between us, and you tick all the boxes we love. Artist, sideman, actor, activist. Oh, it's everything we love, man.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Wait a minute. I don't see Ronnie Cray, do I?
I was going to talk to you about that, because I think you nicked a lot of your style from me, mate. Oh, God.
No, you were fantastic in that, man. Really great.
Well, right. Listen, we both have something in common there as well. And Guy, I just did a TV show in the UK, and Guy was on that too. So all three of us have done the acting and music at the same time.
I've seen you many times, Steve. I've got to say, most memorably, it's always memorable, but I was at Hyde Park when you were with Bruce, when you did the positive, divinely inspired move of opening with London Calling, which was... Man, which you very gamely sang the second verse of.
Was that the same show where they pulled the plug on us?
That's right, on McCartney at the end.
What? They pulled the plug on McCartney.
Paul McCartney comes out with us, and we went 3 minutes past the curfew, and they pulled the plug.
What song were you doing?
Probably I saw her standing there, I think.
Because I saw I saw the film of you doing that at the Roundhouse with Paul, when Paul comes on. Yeah. It's not easy to the same mic with a right hander and a left hander, is it? We're both playing guitars.
No, it's better. Well, it's better.
Yeah, do you think?
Oh no, hang on. No, it's right. No, it's.
Nah, it's not. There's a lot of clash. It's different. Should, listen, yeah. Hey, if you're singing into the same mic as Paul McCartney, you'd do anything. You'd do it on your knees, wouldn't you?
But you know what? Talking of that song, I was at a party a while ago, and I actually got talking to Paul, and for some reason, this thing it came up about. Mistakes that you make on records and stuff that get left. And for some reason, I blurted out, you know, because it's always terrifying saying anything to Paul. Is there anything you've ever done on a record that you thought was a mistake? And he said, oh, well, there's a Beatles song called I Saw Her Standing There. It's like, yeah, okay, yes, heard of it. And he said, apparently, he reckons he fucked it up, but no one else noticed.
How?
On the recording. Yeah, I don't know. I went back and listened to it.
It's still eating him away.
It's impossible to sing that and play the bass line at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just impossible, okay? So if he missed a note here or there, I mean, it's forgivable because, you know, he's playing a different rhythm than he's singing.
Yeah, and what was it like being on stage with him?
I am not exaggerating to say it was a thrill of my life. I mean, one of the great thrills of my life. I mean, coming on stage with the E Street Band was wonderful. He then invited me and Bruce on stage with him at Madison Square Garden, which was great. But coming on my stage, you know, endorsing my music and me, well, I mean, I was a 13-year-old kid. The first album I ever bought was Meet the Beatles in America, which we thought was their first album. It turned out to be the second album.
Right.
But, you know, that was my first album. And then that was my introduction to a whole new world and literally saved my life, you know. And now you're on stage with them. It was quite surreal. And, you know, you have to compartmentalize in those moments. You know, you can't think about being a fan. You have to just treat them as a fellow.
Remember your training. Remember.
Right. You can't be trained for moments like that.
No, I know.
You
know.
But it was wonderful.
You know, I get English guys loving the Beatles because to us, we're almost them. You know, it's the boy next door. It could be us. And in fact, if it wasn't for the Beatles, you know, I mean, what happened to me recently was I was reading the Mark Lewisohn book and ended up in tears at it when Paul meets John. I always end up in tears at that moment. It's the greatest story ever told. None of us would be here if that moment never happened. Well, how was it for American kids who'd listened to music for years and years that was their music, that the Beatles were kind of copying? What is it about the Beatles that was so special?
No. I have to say, I think it was more special than it was for you because it was so alien, you know, so foreign for us. First of all, my generation, I'm a 60s guy, so I missed the 50s, right? I missed the 50s and really early 60s. I started buying some singles. So the Beatles were introducing our own music to us completely. I never heard of Little Richard. I never heard of Chuck Berry.
Wow.
You know, why would I? You know, he was gone by the time we were growing up. So you know, they were, you know, in jail or, you know, Little Richard saw Sputnik and decided, you know, the preacher, you know, I mean, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis married his 13-year-old cousin. You know, I mean, they were all the pioneers were gone. And, you know, and of course, Buddy Holly, you know, died. And you know, so Eddie Cochran died. You know, so we were seeing an amazing moment because I've never been interested in show business exactly. And we had single people, you know, we had whatever, the Elvis Presleys, I suppose, or whoever. We had singing groups like doo-wop. And if you went to your high school dance, it was instrumental groups. So I had never seen a band before. You know, most of us had never seen a band, period. You know, so here they are playing and singing and eventually writing their own songs. We didn't know which one was their songs and which ones weren't. And it was a different communication completely to me. It wasn't me. It was, you know, here's us, here's the team, here's the friends, friendship, community, you know, the posse, the gang.
Yeah.
And that was what attracted me, you know. And I have to say though, by the time we met the Beatles, it was literally halfway through the career. I mean, they started in 57 actually, and were gone by 69. Yeah, yeah. So they were extremely sophisticated. I mean, you know, the harmony was perfect. The hair was perfect and completely new to us. The clothes were perfect and new to us. Everything was new. Their accent and their wit, you know. And so they showed you a new world, which was life-saving. But, you know, you didn't look at them and say, well, geez, I think I could maybe do that, you know. And luckily for us, 4 months later, the Rolling Stones came, you know. And I must say, they're the other half of the story because they made it look easier than it was. They were very casual. They wore whatever they felt like.
Yeah.
Their hair was not perfect, except for Brian Jones. You know, they had no harmony at all. They were really the first punk band. So the way I like to put it is the Beatles revealed a whole new world to us and the Rolling Stones invited us in.
I was like, Pete Townsend had a great way of putting it. He said the thing that the Rolling Stones did was, he said, they just kicked the door shut on show business. You know, that's,
well,
they ended that.
What moved me the most, what really tipped me into really wanting to do this was Mick Jagger was the only person I'd ever seen in show business who didn't smile, you know, and that doesn't sound like a big deal right now, but back then it was a very big deal, you know? And I thought, wow, you know, this is something different. It's not show business anymore. This is a lifestyle, you know. They're on a mission, you know, and they really were on a mission in the beginning, the Stones.
Because the Beatles, they were the bridge, really. You know, they came out of that light entertainment. You know, they had the smiles. You know, Brian made them smile, got them the suits. You know, but they had these weird haircuts for a start, which they got from Germany. But then they become the great revolutionaries in music, doing things that no one else has ever dreamt of before.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they led the way almost in every single step of the way, you know. And what they don't get enough credit for, you know, and I talk about a little bit in a book. I got a new book coming end of September.
Oh, yeah.
We're not going to talk about it too much now. But basically, the thing that they don't get enough credit for, in my opinion, is they invented the concept of evolution, okay? And this is something that we all kind of take for granted now. But in the old days, pre-Beatles, you know, you'd have a hit, and if you had a hit, it was a miracle. And your job was to then have a second hit as close to that first hit as you could possibly make it, yeah. You know? And that was totally accepted in the way it was, you know? The Beatles, you know, all of a sudden, the second album was an evolution from the first. And then the next one was an evolution from that.
Yeah, yeah.
And an evolution from that, you know? And that was a new idea. You know?
Yeah, because I always thought it extraordinary, the idea, if you heard Twist and Shout, there's no way you could picture that Across the Universe was right down the road.
Five years later.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, 5-6 years later. I mean, you know, so I mean, that was something that really helped turn it into an art form. I mean, when the Beatles and Bob Dylan and the Stones and I would say the Byrds as well, they all got together and influenced each other. By 65, it had turned into an art form. But that was one of the reasons.
Although, according to your Rock and Roll Hall of Fame speech, it was the Little Rascals who were the first band.
Yeah, well, you know.
Well, yeah. But, you know,
I can see why you got the Sill gig off that, though.
Steve, I was... let's stay on the Beatles for a second, yeah. Because there's a similarity between Liverpool and New Jersey, right? You know, these are coastal towns. You think that those records that were coming out of America were getting on a boat just down the road from where you lived and getting off the boat just down the road from where McCartney and Lennon lived. And there's a similarity in that sort of outward looking place that you both come from.
With the slight exception, I think we were before the riots. There's before the riots and after the riots in Asbury Park. By the end of the 60s, you know, a lot of cities were rioting because of various reasons. But we were kind of half Liverpool and half Brighton, really. You know, we were a little bit of a, you know what I mean? Like before the town was leveled and became a wasteland, it was actually a resort town, you know? So it was a little bit different than Liverpool, which I picture more of an industrial town, you know? We were more a little bit more of we had the boardwalk and the Ferris wheel and all those kinds of rides and things, which extended right into the 70s when we did our first residency as Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes, which was my first band. I mean, there was nobody living there, but people would still come down on the weekends, you know?
Because there's such a specific kind of, and I would say specific to Asbury Park, but that Jersey sound, which is an R&B sound, but not, and it's so identifiable. But there's a weird thing that New Jersey has of being, it's like, and this comes over a lot in The Sopranos, of that thing of just being right next to New York, but then kind of so far away, being this sort of kid brother almost of kind of.
Well, yeah, it's the also ran, you know, it's the underdog. Right.
It's Croydon. It's Croydon.
We joke about it, you know. We try harder, you know, because you know we're not New York, you know. We're not New York, and we're not Philadelphia, you know. We were in between, you know, and so you know we in a good way. The good part of it was, you know, when you're out of that intense pressure cooker of an inner city, you do have a little bit more of a chance to develop. You know, you can develop in that situation, which is what happened to us in Asbury Park. We really developed who we were going to be. And by the time we started Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes, now keep in mind, we had grown up with the British invasion, as we called it, which really was one in 64. I mean, for you know, a year and a half or so, they were absolutely British, dominated the charts. And
yeah, we're never going to let you forget that. Never.
And put all the heroes out of work, ironically, you know, which was, you know, obviously a you know, unintentional consequence. But the only ones, only a couple of people survived. I mean, the Beach Boys survived, the Four Seasons survived, and soul music survived. Mm-hmm. And what we grew up with was now we had 7, 8, maybe 9 rock and roll TV shows on every week, which is, you know, can you believe that?
We have one. And,
you know, I know, it was a good one. Ready, Steady, Go is a good one. But, you know, you'd have, you know, Rolling Stones would come on, and then Marvin Gaye, you know, and then the Kinks, and then Curtis Mayfield, you know. Yeah. I mean, that was every single show was like that, you know, and even Ready, Steady, Go, to some extent, had the same thing.
Much, yeah.
And so we grew up with that rock and soul thing, you know.
Right.
And basically, that's what merged into Southside Johnny at Barry Jukes. We had the rock and roll guitars with horns, you know, with the horns. So
that's interesting, because I hear a lot of the doo-wop in the Jersey Sound. I can hear that would have been, and there's obviously a great irony here, because doo-wop was formed on street corners by kids who couldn't afford any instruments. And then the Jersey Sound ends up doing doo-wop with about 15 players all on stage at once, playing every single instrument ever invented.
Well, that kind of makes doo-wop the original hip-hop then, doesn't it? Because hip-hop was guys who couldn't get instruments either.
You could argue that. I mean, but we actually did a couple of doo-wop songs, you know, along the way. But
weren't you mostly in a doo-wop band for a bit, those little Steve?
No, that was really little before
Steve.
My time.
Little Steve. Little sorry, a little. I'm so scared.
Excuse me, little Stephen.
We went. We had to go back and discover that stuff. It was really before our time. I mean, you know, I bought a few singles in the early 60s, but really, it literally was the Beatles, the first album I ever bought. So I had to go back and study the 50s, and that included doo-wop, which I love. I'm a big, big fan of doo-wop. I put it in my radio format. You know, it's the only place you can hear doo-wop in the world is in my radio format. And
who would you point us to if we wanted the best doo-wop? Who would you point us to?
Oh, my God. My favorite of all is a song called I'm So Young by the Students, a cat named Leroy King, which I think is probably one of the greatest vocals of all time.
The Students? From
Students, yeah.
That's such a new wave band name.
You get the Jive Five doing What Time Is It? And Our True Story, the Dubs.
But Stephen, Frankie Valli, that was also coming before you as well, wasn't it? And must have influenced the kind of sound you guys were making.
Yeah, yeah. They were coming from like a doo-wop thing, as were the Beach Boys, you know? And funnily enough, those are the two that survived the British invasion, and two of the very few. So yeah, the Four Seasons, Sherry, I think it was 61 or 62, then right away they had Big Girls Don't Cry, Walk Like a Man. They had 5 or 6 fantastic singles in a row. And so they actually survived the invasion, you know, of 64.
Talking of which, there was actual Frankie Valli in The Sopranos, right?
Frankie Valli actually ended up in The Sopranos.
That was your actual Frankie Valli, because I just kept thinking, that's not actually Frankie Valli, is it? Surely that's amazing.
No, that was him. That's him.
Did you get him in?
That was him.
No, do you know what?
Chase is a big music fan. Big music fan.
Oh, no,
I'm sure Guy's going to talk about The Sopranos with you in a bit, because he's a massive, massive Sopranos fan. But I just want to ask you about, because there's an episode, isn't there, where Bruce Springsteen gets mentioned. So if Bruce Springsteen is in The Sopranos universe, where and who is it?
I actually tweet you about, well, no, there's a more meta one than that, isn't there? There's that when Tony is seeing his Gumar, and a little Steven track comes on.
What?
Yeah. And that keeps her, and she says to her, what do you think? And he goes, nah. So yeah, that's incredibly meta stuff. Because I actually tweeted you this a while ago, Steve. I said it's seeing, because Bruce is referenced a lot in The Sopranos. So who's playing guitar for him in that universe?
Oh well,
Hills, I guess.
Yeah, I mean that was the thing. They you know, Scorsese sort of introduced the idea of contemporary, you know, in Mean Streets, you know. by starting with Be My Baby by the Ronettes and Jumpin' yeah. Jack Flash by the Stones, which, you know, not songs you would have associated with the mob, you know, with gangsters before that, you know. So Scorsese, you know, sort of merged the modern world with the whole traditional gangster thing. And I think, you know,
by Casino, it had become parody, though, hadn't it? It's just wall to wall Stones.
Well,
and kind of,
I mean, you know, I didn't appreciate it, that movie when it first came out, because it seemed redundant at the time. It, you know, but you look at it now, and I think it's yeah. an absolutely fantastic movie.
No one
now.
Dressed that cool in the 70s. Although you did, you had that whole, you were very fly, weren't you, with your suits?
For a minute, yes.
Something just occurred to me, and it's relevant to what we were talking about earlier. And I was thinking, you know, New Jersey. And that sound is a little bit of what goes on over here with the Canvey Island sound, wasn't it?
Very much.
Dr. Feelgood, and there's a place not far from London.
We had the Jukes tour with Grant Parker. You know, Grant
Parker. There you go. That's very much yeah.
You know, by his second album, he had some horns, I think, on it. Yeah. Already. You know, so there was a group at the same time. You guys called it pub rock, you know.
Yeah.
It was bar band rock for us, almost exactly the same time. The Jukes, Mink DeVille.
Oh, yeah, God, yeah.
Spanish Troll.
Graham Parker, Elvis Costello, Dave Edmonds, you know, all part of the same, even Huey Lewis.
Man, I want you on my pub quiz team. You've got your stuff down.
Well, no, I was there.
I had to be there. But I suppose, because we had John Bon Jovi on the show a few weeks ago, and I love saying that, by the way. It sounds good. Now we've got you on. And the similarity is that they all come out of cultures where a bar band plays every song that they know, whatever the audience shout out. They've got such an armory of songs under their belt. And that's kind of what you know, John was saying, that's what it's like down on the Jersey Shore.
Yeah, and then, you know, Johnny took the more pop route, you know, because he's smarter than the rest of us. And, you know,
yeah, because you guys were much more in tune, that arm, it was seen much more in tune with the kind of sort of punk or new wave sensibility that was happening everywhere else, as opposed to the hair.
Yeah, we had a street thing that was just, it was very natural for us, you know. And you know, and it was sort of, and there's nothing wrong with it, you know, but you know, the Bruce Springsteen route was different than the Billy Joel route, let's just put it that way, you know. Nothing wrong with Billy, I love him, you know, but you know, there was a sort of a pop sensibility there, you know, as opposed to a rock sensibility. And the 80s was just everybody peaked, you know, everybody was able to combine everything and sell ridiculous amounts of records, you know.
That's true. No, because I was going to say, so I wanted to get to where you started, because you were playing bass for a while, weren't you?
Well, in a group called Steel Mill, we had a different band every, you know, 3 months or so, you know. A band would last about 3 months. Whoever was leading it, sometimes it would be my band, sometimes it would be Bruce's. Bruce had a group called Steel Mill, and the bass player, whatever, something happened. He said, do me a favor, just play bass for a minute. So I did, and people have been sending some of those songs on Twitter lately, and they're quite remarkable songs, that group Steel Mill. I mean, very weird, very strange. Bruce had just started writing, and was writing in a very bizarre and interesting way that I'm actually appreciating more now than ever. But anyway, they're just recordings from somebody in the audience, you know, but crazy wow. songs. That
well, because Bruce's early writing was, he was very, very wordy and Dylan-y and much, wasn't he, before he
that was the first thing that the public was introduced to, you know. But there was a lot before that, you know. Mm-hmm. And before that, it was more instrumentally oriented. The average Steel Mill song was 8-9 minutes and went all over the place.
Prog!
What? What was it like? Tower of Power or something?
Not so much. No horns, you know. Steel Mill was just 4-piece, you know, but the big B3, it was like early Deep Purple, I'd say.
All right. Oh, okay.
You know, where the organ was a big part of it, the big B3. And, you know, a bit of Rhinoceros, which you may not be familiar with.
Oh, God.
You know.
That's the first and the last time they're ever going to be mentioned on this podcast.
And we actually did some gigs with the Allman Brothers So we were kind of similar to them.
Right.
Of course, because they were long. They've long. Yeah.
Yeah. Before they made it, we were playing together several gigs.
I spoke earlier about that great moment in cultural history when Paul met John. We need to know the moment that you met Bruce, because that's an equivalent, right? And before you met him, what was he like from afar?
Well, what's interesting, and what's most interesting about the Beatle thing is there's pictures of it, for Christ's sake. I mean, you know, talk about an entire life being photographed. I mean, there's pictures from the face, you know, I mean, isn't that unbelievable? There's pictures the day Paul met. I mean, you know, that's
I still look at them, Stephen. I still look at them. I mean, for clues. I'm looking for clues.
You know, it was not as eventful with us. You know, I had a local band and he had a local band. We keep in mind there were no bands in America, right? February 8th, 1964. February 9th, the Beatles played a variety show.
None.
I'm not kidding. They're all instrumental groups, you know, or doo-wop group, like I said, or the Elvis Presley's, you know, Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet, you know. And February 10th, everybody in America had a band. I'm not kidding. In the garage. Now, most of them, you know, mercifully stayed there. Yeah. But about a dozen of us got out of the garage and became the circuit in our area, you know. And Bruce had one band and I had another. And he was... a completely different person then. He was very, very quiet, never spoke. You know, we had very long hair and kind of grungy. Grungy would be the best description, you know, how you picture grunge, you know. And I got very, you know, we just became very good friends because we were the only two people that really were completely 100% into rock and roll as a religion, you know. I mean, there was no plan B for us. We were just complete freaks. Misfits, you know, had no place in society whatsoever, you know. I mean, everybody, even the other 12 bands in the area, as soon as they had an option, they took it, you know, to go to college, to join the military, join their fathers, go work for their father, or, you know, the only two guys left standing were me and him.
What was your home? I mean, were you fighting against stuff at home, or was
oh my
you
god? To... No, we
don't get him started.
My father was an ex-Marine, Goldwater Republican. You know, I don't know, which means the beginning of the conservative movement was a guy named Barry Goldwater. So we defined the generation gap that you may have heard about.
Yeah,
We embarrassed our parents. You know, they were. You know, I feel sorry for them now, but you know, they thought we were, you know, drug addicts and just hopelessly, you know, done. And, you know, and I eventually got kicked out of the house and kicked out of school because of my long hair. And, you know, we just didn't fit in, you know? So we really strengthened each other, I think, in a very profound way, I think at that moment in time, which why we're still best friends to this day, you know, we really, I think, needed each other. Just to have one person thinking the same way made you think you're not completely insane, you know? Because it was a real long shot to make it, you know, in rock and roll from New Jersey. You know, I mean, it's even harder now, to be honest. But back then, it was a long shot that you really, I mean, your parents would say, what are you going to do, be a Beatle? You know, you're going to be a Rolling Stone? You know, and if you were honest with yourself, you had to say, you know.
No, I'm going to be in the E Street Band.
You want to be that, don't you? That's what we all wanted to be.
That's it. I mean, and you know, we just miraculously, we made it.
But when did you realize that you were going to be Bruce's sideman? Was there ever a moment when you wanted him to be your sideman?
I was actually quite popular, and my band was actually more popular than his. You know, we won all the battle of the bands. There was a lot of battles of the bands in those days, and we always won, you know. And so at a certain point, I just felt, you know, he started writing earlier than me, and he just had a vision that was quite quite definite about where he was going. And I just felt, you know what, I can do some things that he can't. I was very good at my ear was very was better than his. You know, I could hear things. You know, I was a good arranger very beginning. You know,
I want to get to that.
You know, and you know, so I could hear more musical things in different ways. I thought I could really compliment him, and so at a certain point, you know, I was a boss in my world. And when I joined him and started calling him the boss, then people started taking it seriously because wow. I was like,
"Did you come up with the boss? Is that you? Did you coin that?"
Well, he started joking about it because Frank Sinatra was called the boss, you know.
Right.
So he started joking about it when he was absolutely meant nothing, you know. He still, you know, started joking about calling himself the boss. I mean, and but you know, nobody took it seriously. But when I started calling him the boss, people were like, "Wait a minute." You know,
we thought
you were the boss, you know.
That's great. He's the boss of bosses.
Yes. That's it.
It's an Italian thing, right?
Yeah. That's right.
So what are you going to do? What are you going to do? No, because isn't apparently, we were talking about the what Bruce has said is your, I don't know if I'm jumping forward too far here. Bruce said is your greatest contribution to Born to Run is you saved the guitar riff. Right?
Yeah.
You didn't write the riff. You saved the riff.
You need that story
yeah,
again?
We won that.
Yeah, come on.
Yeah, we
yeah. Come on. Oh, sorry, God. Mate. I'm sorry, mate.
All right, quickly.
Don't
quickly.
You just have it recorded? Can't you just hit play? And it...
My greatest sound bites. Let's see. How can I do the short version of this? Basically, his first two records didn't do anything. And his career looked like it depended on this what he's going to do next. So they worked for literally for months on one song, and this song Born to Run, and you know, and it sounds like it's quite amazing, one of the great songs of all time,
telling me
great records of all time, yeah, so anyway, yeah. So they work on it literally for months, and Gary, you know what that means. I mean, you know, it, you know, working on a song for days is one thing. Weeks is already pushing it, you know?
Yeah,
but months, yeah. You know, it's like ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
So they finally get the mix. And in those days, I think this was a 16 track, if I'm not mistaken, the 16 track machine, which makes it even more complicated.
Yeah.
So they spent God knows how long mixing it. He invites me up, I go up and I listen to it. And I said, wow, that is just fantastic, man. You know, and I especially like that the minor riff is so just so fucking cool. You know, and he says, what? I said, you know, the minor riff. You know, it's like a real Roy Orbison kind of move. You're kind of like it's something the Beatles would do. You know, and he's like, what minor riff?
Oh.
The minor riff in the chord. He's like, he throws me the guitar. I said, what are you talking about? So what had happened was he's bending the note, playing like a Duane Eddy type of riff, right, with a lot of reverb, right? And he's bending the note, and where he's bending it from is the minor, and he's bending it to the major. But, you know, after working on it for months, what they think they're hearing, you know, is what I just said, bending the note to the major note. But actually, I only heard where he's bending it from. I never hear where he's bending it to because yeah, yeah. The reverb
yeah.
is you know, is right. making it go away, you know. So,
but it's unsettled.
The riff is down, da 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 da, right, da da da, right, da da da
yeah,
da.
Yeah.
I'm hearing da 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 da.
Oh. Oh, yeah.
Right? Which I think is absolutely great.
But it's sad. Know? It's sad. It's not uplifting.
Yeah. It's a little yeah. less triumphant.
Yeah, actually, yeah. We didn't spend 6 months for sad.
Exactly. So, you know, so finally he hears what I'm hearing, you know, and he's like, oh my fucking God, you know. And he goes in there and tells them, and oh, geez, forget about it.
But, thank you. From the world.
I saved his career, yes, you know.
But did you play the guitar in the end? Did you go in and do the riff?
No. I wasn't in the band.
That's what you were. But then you walked in, didn't you? And on the spot, did the horn chart for 10th Avenue Freeze Out.
That was another session. He invited me up.
Oh, you didn't do it the same session. Oh, I am disappointed.
No. He'd invite me up now and then, you know. And after a while, they stopped inviting me, obviously.
Yeah.
He'll make us change shit.
I'm lying on the floor. Now, keep in mind, you know, this was a different studio now. This is the record plant.
Yeah.
Quite a famous studio.
Right.
And you know, here we are working our entire lives to get into the music business, you know, and we're so excited about it. And you know, pretty late in life. I mean, you know, relatively. He's signed when he's 22, 23. Anyway, I'm lying on the floor. And the 70s was the worst possible time to record. The engineers had taken over in a coup d'etat and decided that they needed separation and clarity and padding and everything that rock and roll hates. Okay. So what they would do is they would take all the life out of the recording. And then they would put it all back in the mix.
You know? I mean, yeah.
So I'm lying on the floor, you know, and I'm listening to the recording 10th Avenue, and it just sounds terrible, you know. It just sounds terrible to begin with, because everything's so padded, you know. And they're doing this ridiculous horn chart, you know. And Bruce made the mistake of saying, you know, what do you think? You
know, no! You know,
I'm not in the business. You know, I'm a street kid. You know, I don't give a fuck about anything.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome. Like, what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome. Like, what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, or you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
So you're just his mate at this point. You're not in the band.
No. Just a friend, you know. We've been friends years before. Yeah. You know, 10 years, 10 years before.
And by the way, we all know, we've all been in the studio with the artist's mate coming in and telling us what we should be doing.
Yeah.
I mean, that you do not want to be that guy.
Exactly. So, you know, he says, what do you think? I said, this fucking sucks, right? And silence, you know, dead silence. I mean, there's managers, there's engineers, there's producers, you know, there's like...
Oh, you had tons, didn't you? There's Landau, there's Appel, there's Iovine. I mean, yeah, man, yeah. I mean, cooks.
I loved, he was advertising himself at the time. Get little Stephen in, he'll tell you how shit your track is.
So he says... All right, then go in there and fucking fix it, you know? So I said, all right, I will, you know? And I went in there and I sang them some parts, and you know, they had a baritone, a tenor, and a trumpet. I think
it was the Breckers, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I didn't know it was the most.
Fuck, it's the fucking Brecker brothers. Yeah, I'm just going to go and tell the Brecker brothers what to do.
Wow.
And then Dave Sanborn. Right? The Brecker brothers and Dave Sanborn. You know, the most famous, players. So I sing them the parts and.
Yeah. Hey, Miles, not like that.
Who'd written the part before?
That with Miles.
No, but who'd written the part before?
I don't know. Somebody must have made some kind of chart, but we just redid it, and that's what you hear on the record. You know?
Where did you learn that stuff, Stephen? What was your back in music? What was your background?
Just from listening to records. You know, I don't read or write to this day.
Yay.
You know, but I started arranging horns and strings. The very first production of I Don't Want to Go Home for the Jukes.
Wow.
Arranged all the horns and the strings.
So how do you arrange strings? You just go because you know, classically trained players, you can't, you know, they don't. How do you do that?
You gotta have charts. Yeah. But I get an orchestrator and I sing them the part. You know, in the beginning, I would orchestrate as well. Through the years, you know, if I use the same guys over and over, I don't have to go through each single part. I can just sing the main melodies and, you know. And do a shortcut because they know how I want things orchestrated. If I hear something I don't like in terms of a voicing, I'll change it, you know. But in the beginning, I was doing the voicings and everything, you know. Viola does this, a cello does that, and, you know, I was just making it up as I went, you know. I just, you know.
Big boom.
I mean, that's what it is, isn't it? It's just
Exactly. That's what the Beatles were doing, right? You know, it's what everyone was doing, was just, you know.
They had a little, George Martin had a little bit more education than
so,
I did.
So, yeah, Stephen, when did you join? When did the E Street Band happen?
Well, right after that, Bruce decided he had, like I said, the career was in big trouble. And they had 7 gigs booked for the new Born to Run album coming out. And so he said, I want to put the guitar down. You know, it's not really working right now. I'm going to try fronting the band for a minute, seeing if that makes a difference. So, you know, will you play guitar for a minute? And so I was tired of the Jukes, you know, because I was managing the band as well as producing them and co-singing. You know, we were like Sam and Dave, you know, we had two singers. And, you know, so I'm fighting with the club owners all the time. You know, I needed a break. So I said, all right, let me come out for a couple of weeks. I'll play guitar, you know. So I went out for 7 gigs, basically, and then stayed 7 years.
But that's the footage of the show from that time. What's extraordinary, and I think what took everyone's breath away when we saw this in the UK, is, you know, the Beatles, like you were saying, there was a sense of family there. But this was absolute family, a gang on stage, you know. And Bruce was the Fonz, right? He's the greatest leader of this gang. And I wonder, you know, I wonder if there is a bit of coming from Italian backgrounds that has anything to do with what we were seeing and feeling.
Well, you know, maybe. I mean, we both, it's funny, me and Bruce are both Italians with Dutch names. which is weird. But, in my case, I was adopted by my Dutch father. So I'm 100% Italian. I think Bruce is some other percentage, you know, 50 or 60% Italian.
But there's a family thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's my orientation personally. You know, I even when I started making my solo records, I made sure the band was like a family. That's just my own personal thing. Bruce, I think, has it to some extent also. And although he has more of a natural inclination split down the middle of a band guy and a solo guy, you know, he enjoys being the solo guy as well, which I never did really. Especially, I mean, solo, like on stage with an acoustic guitar solo.
The ultimate expression of that, I would say, is when you went on to do, Sun City, is just the sheer amount of people you got in to do that.
I listened to Sun City again today. What a song. It has not dated in the slightest. I mean, you listen to Feed the World or whatever, you know, they're dated. Sun City could come out of the box today. I mean, it's a phenomenal track. You, what you did in with Arthur Baker as well. It was
Townsend intro will get me every time.
was it actually him?
Was that just you playing like him?
You gotta love him. It was a different mission in a way. You know what I mean? We weren't going for the biggest celebrities. We were going for people who had said something with their work or was, you know, engaged socially somehow. And that was the way we chose those people. So it ended up more diverse, you know. And we had, you know, things like salsa represented with Ruben Blake and Ray Barreto, you know, reggae was represented with Jimmy Cliff, you know, some of the more, you know, the lesser important sort of genres were in there, you know. And we, you know, the mission was a bit different. It was a motivational song, you know, it was a song about revolution, you know.
But it covers an entire record, just the people on that record are the basis of an entire and very complete record collection.
Plenty of people have written protest songs, including Dylan, who's on your protest song. But I think what's so clever about that protest song is it's really reaching out there and it's trying to get people's feet involved first. It gets people's heart involved before their brain. And I think that's the great skill of it.
But that's the difference. That's the difference between, I think, you know, political music and social, you know, social issues, you know, feeding people in Africa is, you know, you're working from the heart, you know, and this, you're working from the fist. We really, you know, we political music, you know, you're pointing your finger, you know, it's like, this is wrong. This is why, this is, you know, how we fix it. You know, this is the list of people we need to, like, you know, get, you know, it's that kind of specifics that changed the attitude of it.
Well, that's the basis of rock and roll, isn't it? You're literally pointing out the man, you know, you're standing up to the man. I mean,
Ronald Reagan was God in those days, but, you know, people don't remember this. Yeah. You know, he was literally God. And to mention him in the song, you know, it took a lot of courage for those artists to join in on that.
Well, a lot of American radio stations wouldn't play the song, would they?
Nobody would. We thank God MTV was having a fight at the time because they weren't playing any black artists.
That's right.
Right. So I went into MTV and I said, listen, I can solve your black artist problem with one video. Okay. I have more black artists in this video, than you've played all year, you know? And luckily they bought that. And you know, so if people heard the record, they heard it from MTV and a black network called BET. You did not hear the song on the radio. It was too black for white radio and too white for black radio.
Because,
you know?
I remember hearing, like, for instance, of all people, I remember hearing Daryl Hall being interviewed about it. And he said, well, you know, I don't want to call out any names. Actually, yes, I do. And then he just listed everyone who played Sun City. And it was like, Daryl got his game, you know, that was amazing.
Well, it was a big discussion as to, because, you know, we had a couple of rabble-rousers, you know, in the group, you know, there was four of us. Me, Danny Schechter, who was a natural-born troublemaker. Art Perry, who videoed everything, thank God. And Arthur Baker.
We love Arthur,
Because, you know, I mean, without Arthur's phone book, you know, it would have been five people, you know. So Danny, thinking, we're going to need publicity, because it wasn't an issue in America. You know, it was a big issue in England and in Europe. You know, your unions were very strong.
Yeah, I played an anti-apartheid concert in Hyde Park in 1985. And there was 100,000 people there, you know, still.
Because, of course, you know, you had Reagan, and of course we had Thatcher, who was having a big, massive love affair with Reagan, and we weren't applying sanctions to South Africa, so remember, so we were the bad guys too.
Mm. Oh, no, it was the evil trinity of Reagan, Thatcher, and Kohl in Germany.
Yeah.
But I think Jerry Dammers, you know, Free Nelson Mandela had come out, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it wasn't an issue in America, really. You know, Danny says, let's mention who played there and get some controversy for publicity, you know, and we even did a demo mentioning some names, and in the end I said, no, I really want, it's going to end up being a distraction. I want to try and keep the music people as a family together here. Let's keep our eye on the ball, you know, which is, you know, establishing the cultural boycott so we can get to the economic boycott, which is the home run, you know, in the end. And that's what we did. So I met with Queen and I met with a few people who had been there. And they, by going there, by the way, they had gotten themselves onto the United Nations blacklist, which was quite serious because the unions in Europe were taking that list seriously. So a lot of people who had played there were going to have trouble working, you know, and it was a few. So I met with them and they said, you know, how do we get off this list? And I said, listen, just say you're not going to go back. It's as simple as that. You're not going back to Sun City. I'm going to take the position that you were manipulated, you were fooled, you thought you were playing a different country, which is how they advertised it.
Yeah.
You know? And they really overpaid everybody, you know. And I said, you know, so I said, we're going to assume that you were manipulated, you were fooled into doing it, and you're not going to go back. That's all you have to do, and I'll get you off the list because the UN was sending everybody to me.
This is still coming into play here. I'll get you off the list.
I got everybody off the list, and even Paul Simon, who ended up, you know, being the one.
Well, he was in trouble for the wrong way around, wasn't he? Because he'd been working with Ladysmith Black Mambazo, who are black South African musicians.
He intentionally violated the boycott. He was opposed to the boycott. Oh. So, you know, me and him ended up, you know, a bit of a problem. But he was the only exception. Everybody else, you know, said we're not going back. You know, and we shut down Sun City overnight. You know, we were very, very, very successful.
Incredible.
How good did that feel?
Well, one of the most amazing moments of my life was watching Mandela come out of jail. I mean, that was, you know,
you had some hand in that.
Because you didn't really quite believe that that would ever happen. And they really, you know, once we overrode Reagan's veto of the economic sanctions, then it felt like dominoes, and they had to let him out. And out he came, and oh my God, it was like a miracle, you know?
Amazing. Listen, Stephen, you know, a lot of what you and Bruce have always sung about, and a lot of what the Jersey Sound is about, is it's about singing about the underdog. It's about singing about the urban man who and his struggle and the sense that he's disenfranchised. And obviously your allegiance, well, certainly Bruce has been, you know, publicly been Democrat. Suddenly you've not got the old fashioned left and right in your country. And it's more about identity politics. And it's more about Trump comes along and he's suddenly the guy who's for the urban man. How does that feel? Was there a sense at some point that you'd felt not deserted, but you were no longer the voice for that guy, and that was frustrating?
Oh my God, it's a big subject. But basically, we've been living in an insane asylum, you know, for 4 years, you know, and I feel the same way about Brexit, by the way.
Thank you.
equally big mistake as Trump. Yeah. But
it's the same people. It's the same people behind it.
Yeah, I mean the Tories are the Republicans, as far as I'm concerned. But this became the biggest scam, the biggest hustle, the biggest con in history. And he's just the greatest con man that ever lived. And he conned the working class into thinking he was for them. Mm-hmm. You know, and the Republicans, who've never done a single thing for the working class to this day. I mean, even the relief bill, which has been in the House of Representatives for, you know, 10 months while Trump was still there, you know, McConnell and the Republicans just refused to help anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, they couldn't care less. So I don't know. I've reduced this whole thing in my mind, you know, to this, which is, I mean, 74 million people voted for Trump. Okay. After he murdered 500,000 people, and I consider him the biggest mass murderer in history, in America anyway. Why? Why are people voting for this guy, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, but I've reduced it to the fact that they are completely scared of or hate black people, okay? They are scared to death of immigrants and blame immigrants, mm-hmm. and they blame black people for all of their problems. And I know that sounds ridiculous in this 21st century, but I'm telling you right now, it's a fact. It's fear of the black man that is completely irrational, you know? It's the only possible explanation for voting for this guy.
Well, you have said, you very brilliantly said on record that the problem is because there is no integration that could be sorted out in one generation, right?
We've never integrated our country, you know? I mean, I talk about some of this in the book, although I didn't want to spend too much time with politics in the book. But it was, you know, we have to now accept the fact that in our case, we were founded as a white supremacist country, okay? Mm. That was our, you know, with an asterisk. And the asterisk is, well, a couple of the guys feel guilty about it, you know. So they put the ideals are present in our founding fathers, you know, all men are created equal type stuff. It's all in there. But the fact was, slavery was in the Constitution. You know, women had no equality in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Now we're slowly fixing these things. You know, we haven't fixed our integration yet. Yeah. You know?
If the greatest integration that ever happened in America was music, surely. I mean, that's the cultural integration.
No. So all youth movement, all great cultural movements come from white kids and black kids checking each other out.
E Street Band was one of the first mixed race bands, really. I mean, there were two black guys in there.
Yeah, we were one of the biggest. One of the first was actually a Paul Butterfield blues band.
Oh, yeah.
It was a fantastic band. And
Sly, funny enough.
Sly and
Andy Newmark playing drums.
Love.
So there wasn't too many, but we got Clarence with the saxophone was a nod to tradition as well. So we were kind of carrying on the tradition of rock as well as the integration of rock. But I think that's
why that Born to Run cover is such a powerful image, isn't it? That was such a great, you know.
Yeah.
It took the Alan Freeds of the world to play black music for the white kids, because our radio was segregated entirely. Black radio played this, white radio played that.
That's the right, because that's the thing we never had. You know, we always complained that our radio was, should we just have Radio 1? But you heard everything. You heard everything on that one station.
Yeah, by the late 50s, we were hearing everything. We had fantastic radio.
But I mean, then you had FM, everything. You had your rock star. That's why you end up with, like, Disco Sucks, which is the most out-and-out racist campaign there's ever been, right? Isn't it?
Can I just go back onto this your fantastic arranging and your E Street Band family? There's a great clip on YouTube of a few years ago. You look like you're in a football stadium somewhere, it's the bit where Bruce is taking requests from the audience.
Oh yeah.
And you end up doing You Never Can Tell, the Chuck Berry song, but you've never done it before. Yeah. And you pull it together, you decide what the key is going to be, and the whole band ends up rocking this tune. And there's my favorite bit at the end is you're going between whatever your key you're in, maybe you're in G, so you're going between D and G. And then as it ends, Bruce holds up four fingers and you all go to the fourth chord. I mean, you know, what a band. I mean, how is that? Are you shitting bricks when he does all that stuff?
No, he's gotten used to it, you know. We grew up with that stuff. I mean, you know, it's the James Brown thing, really.
Yeah.
James Brown was the guy who was giving these signals and people were reacting very, very spontaneously. So we kind of comes from that, but we've been doing it a long time. And, you know, we just started taking requests, which was a new idea.
From 80,000 people, how do you do that? Sorry, I didn't. what?
We rehearse it right on stage, you know. So it's a way of turning a stadium into a club. You know what I mean? It really is.
And Stephen, you guys. I mean, the songs you can pull out of the bag overnight. I mean, there's that in the wonderful footage I've seen of you going to the Cavern Club to do that lunchtime gig.
Yeah, your whole Mecca thing, fantastic. Yeah.
And you're all in the back, and the whole band are learning, like, you know, 20 Beatles songs, you know, in seconds. And then there are more of you in the venue than audience, because there's so many musicians.
We grew up with that ability to learn things quickly. And that particular, you know, once Paul came on stage, which was, you know, just a miracle, put me in a Beatley mood even more than usual. And we're heading to Liverpool. And I remembered that, you know, when the Beatles started, they did this crazy thing that can only happen in England, called, you know, lunchtime sets.
That's how they started at the Cavern.
Yeah.
And the clerks in the shop, you know, the secretaries would bring their lunch to the Cavern, and the Beatles would play for half an hour. Now, this is such a wonderful eccentricity, you know. I mean, it's just crazy, right?
Well, it's to take their minds off how awful their lunch is, because lunch in Liverpool in 1960 was not good.
So I said, call the Cavern. Tell them we're playing Liverpool Saturday night, and I want to do a lunchtime set, you know. And they call up and say, "Well, we haven't done that in 40 or 50 years, but why not?" You know. So on the way, we had like 4 days, And I said, okay, let's do half the set of Beatles songs with horns, because nobody ever hears the Beatles songs with the horns, you know. And the other half, we'll do cover songs that the Beatles actually played at the Cavern, you know.
Oh, nice. They
assumed I wanted to play the bigger room because they have a bigger room now. That's where Paul played. And I said, no, I have to have the room, you know, for the only film that we've ever seen is the Beatles doing Some Other Guy with the Arches. I have to be in the room with the Arches. So we barely fit the rhythm section on the stage. You can see in the DVD.
I know, I've seen it. It's mad.
There's a wall, you know, and the horns and the girls are on the other side. We couldn't see them, you know. So we kind of end the songs around the same place, but we couldn't see each other.
How amazing. Listen, I know you're going to have to go soon, but I know Guy doesn't want to let you go without them.
Well, there's not really anything I want to say. It's just that I'm such a huge Sopranos fan.
Plenty of time for you, sir.
Oh, wow. Okay. Oh, man. No, because there's just so much. Because I wondered, you're clearly such a good person. So when you were offered that role, and is that David Chase literally just saw you give that little rascal speech and said, this guy's got to be in my show?
Yeah.
I mean, admittedly, I've watched that speech and it is the most New Jersey thing I've ever seen. I mean, it is like you are auditioning for the part of this guy. It really is. We're going, some guys were making some noise in England. I mean, it's amazing. But apparently you said your thing was that you didn't want to take an actor's job because you said these guys learn and everything, you know. And David Chase gave you some bullshit about how he's invented a character, although the idea that there wouldn't be a Consigliori is frankly a bit of a stretch.
No. I watched him invent it because it wasn't in the pilot. I read the pilot script and there was no
Okay. Because what's interesting, because
you're turning into a total fanboy now, Guy.
I know. No, I was going to say, I wondered how hard, because Syl manages to stay out of trouble for a lot of the stuff you do is kind of okay. You only get into a couple of fights and stuff. It's not until the Adriana thing that's really, really dark. And I just wondered if you had trouble with that. Because like, you know, James Gandolfini had real trouble playing such a dark person because he was clearly such a kind man. He had that kindness that showed in his eyes, didn't he? Which is what made you root for him.
Well, I mean,
or you know, you just think it's acting? I don't care. I'll kill them all.
Yeah, I mean, you got to kind of create. You know, I'd written a biography about the guy, and you know, and I made sure I looked like the guy in my head. You know, I found out where John Gotti got his clothes made. I had to, because you know, like I said, I lived through my wife was the real actor in the family. I you know, she'd gone to acting school and done off Broadway and you know, and so I'd watched her what she went through as an actor. And that's why I said to Dave, I said, you know, geez, she's watching what Maureen goes through. I really feel guilty taking a job, you know, of somebody who's gone through all that, you know. And he literally said, no, I'm gonna write you in a part. I want you in the show, you know. So he asked me, he says, you know, what would you like to play? What kind of role? And I said, well, I never thought about acting before, but I had thought about writing and you know, I had written a treatment about an independent hitman named Silvio Dante, who opens a club called the Copacabana, you know, Copacabana style club, but in present day. And, you know, and it has all of those old, you know, the big band and the Jewish Catskills comics and the dancing girls. But it's set in present day. So he kind of lives in the past and he kind of looks like the past. And the five families have their own tables and the police commissioner and the mayor have table, you know, their own tables. And a lot of it, and the drama all takes place in the club, kind of like a mafia version of a Casablanca, you know? And so David really liked the idea and he went away and came back a day later and said, well, HBO says we can't really afford that idea, but we'll make it a strip club instead. And you'll run the club for the family, and we'll use the back room as their clubhouse, you know, as their office. And then by the second season, it really turned into the consigliere and the underboss, you know.
Right.
But at first, I was just like one of the guys, one of Tony's friend, you know, a friend of Tony Soprano, and. So it kind of grew, you know, as it went.
Well, one thing that's so brilliantly observed is the fact that they're so self-referential, like all the, like your big quote that you always have to come up with. I'm not going to ask you to do it, even though I'd love you to, just when I thought I was out. But that's right. From The Godfather, right? That's not even your quote. I mean, that's the lovely thing. And the Bada Bing is called the Bada Bing from the golf. You know, it's so fantastically meta in that way.
Well, we're intentionally impersonating the Godfather in that moment. The role of the Godfather actually did play a major role in the real mafia. You know, even though a lot of the Godfather movies are not exactly how the mafia works. You know, but to some extent, a lot of the younger mob guys were learning from the Godfather how to be a gangster. You know,
yeah.
It was a very very art imitating life, imitating art situation going on in real life. I mean,
yeah.
So, you know, we reflected some of that in The Sopranos.
But how much, and so how, I'm just intrigued, how pervasive is the mob in Jersey? I mean, how much of a part is, because it's all, a lot of it's quite shitty nickel and dime DVD players, and isn't it? It's...
The genius of the show, I think, among other things, was taking what has become an extremely boring job now. Half of them are, you know, sitting around reading the racing form all day, you know, mm-hmm. I'm sure, from what I hear, and making a very boring lifestyle, actually, compelling somehow, you know?
Yeah.
And the genius of David Chase was making that compelling. And I think he did it by the universal challenge of people who have to balance their work life and their family life, you know? Now, granted, you know, this work happens to be, you know, the mob, which is a bit exaggerated for most people. But the universal truth of that balance, I think, is what ended up becoming so popular. You know?
Yeah, because frankly, it's got that great thing. It's like there's a screenwriter who said, like, the sign of a great horror movie is if you take the horror out, it's still a great movie. Right. And The Sopranos has that in that if you took the mob stuff out, it's still a great show. It's still just these midlife crisis guys, family, growing families
in
suburban New Jersey. You
there are only
I mean?
Seven stories. There are only seven stories. That's what they say. So, yeah. Bruce and Stephen have written most of them in their songs. Stephen, where are you now? How's your lockdown been? That's what I want to know.
I luckily had the most productive last 3 years of my life, 17, 18, and 19. Honestly, I got six album packages done, through two tours, two new albums, you know, released the Lilyhammer score I had done, remastered all my masters again, literally six packages, and a seventh one's coming out in June, the Summer of Sorcery live DVD. So I had the most productive 3 years, you know, toured around the world twice, and, you know, I kind of was okay with staying home for a minute. Actually.
And you did Bruce's album as well.
The pandemic was actually just what you needed, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, because I cut the tour short, luckily, thinking that we were going to tour with the E Street Band summer of 2020. So I said, you know, let's leave a few months. So I stopped the tour like November 6th, and we were in the studio like November 15th or something. And Bruce booked 5 days. And I thought, well, that's a little strange, but okay, you know, maybe you just want to try some things out. And then, you know, then we'll really get into it and, you know, spend a couple of months. We did the whole album in 4 days. We had nothing to do on the fifth day. We sat around drinking tequila, listening to the record. I mean,
do you know, it's a beautiful film that, and it came out, you know, at a time when none of us could see our friends. And it really made me cry when, you know, beautiful black and white photography, when you guys all walk into that studio, that wonderful barn studio he has, and you're all meeting each other, and the sense of camaraderie and friendship and coming together again have really spoke to me at that moment.
Yeah. Like, luckily, just before the quarantine, you know, obviously, just a month or two before the quarantine hit. And so that was good timing. Just happened to be good timing. So, yeah. So I got six album packages plus the E Street Band record, you know. So, you know, I've been happy to be home, to be honest. I'm not a big socializer anyway. And, you know, my dog appreciates it. I'm not sure my wife does, but, you know, my wife's ready for this virus to be over, I think.
So what are the plans?
But I travel so much. I mean, I travel all the time. So
where is home, Steve?
Manhattan. I'm in Greenwich Village.
And you've been writing?
I spent the whole pandemic basically writing the book, yeah.
Oh, right, right.
So, no, tell us about the book. So that's coming out in September. That's all done, right?
It's coming out September, yeah. And it was tough. It was a challenge because there's a lot of stuff. For me, it's not a matter of what you put in; it's a matter of what you leave out.
Gary and I have both written books. We do.
You feel like
I just knew what I was going to leave out. I was going to leave him out. That's all I'd planned on doing right from the start. That was my sort of main thing.
it was quite a challenge. I felt like I don't really care that much about my life. I think along the way, I've found some things that can be useful to others. And I'm hoping that's what people take away from the book is, I've learned a few things along the way, basically. I'm one of the great advisors of the world not because I'm smart, it's because I'm so stupid, And I've fucked up every possible way somebody can fuck up. So when I suggest something, people should listen because yeah. I know.
Like
I
Bruce know did.
Well, sometimes he did, sometimes he didn't. But
listen, it's been such a pleasure having you on here. Oh,
because I said you've got so much to teach. Because you've given so much to us, Steve, in so many ways. I mean, as an activist, as a musician, as an actor. I mean, it's brilliant. We thank you. Well,
thank Salute you. You.
Great to meet you all, and hopefully see you in person eventually.
Well, indeed. Yeah.
Good luck. What's the book called? What's the book called? Do you know yet?
Unrequited Infatuations.
Beautiful. Oh, what an amazing guy he was.
That could have just gone on. What was so sweet he clearly would be happy to talk for longer, but you can't take the piss.
Well, no, you can't. And there are people listening whose ears must be burning because we all three of us at one point were just gabbing so excitedly.
It's brilliant. He's just got so much information.
That's the reason why I love doing this show as well, because, to be in the same feeling that I'm in the same room as little Stephen and having that connection with the E Street Band and with Bruce and some of the greatest stuff in music history. It's such a thrill.
And the hope that just maybe something will rub off through osmosis, just a little something.
Yes, a little bit.
Stardust.
Down the Zoom line. So listen, thank you for listening. We are the Rockonteurs, Guy and I, and we want to say thanks Ben, our producer.
Yep.
And thank you, of course, for being so nice and tuning in, and so many of you now listening. And hopefully we'll keep these coming, won't we, Guy?
Coming, absolutely. If it's the last thing we do.
You've got a few rock stars in your wardrobe, haven't you?
I think there's a couple of phone numbers left. I haven't worn them all out. Same with you.
Good. So we'll keep phoning and you keep listening. Thank you, and we'll see you next week. It's good night from me.
And good night from her.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.